Who remembers something from yesterday's class? Who remembers what day of the week it was yesterday? I'll start early with an easier question. Huh? Okay. I have to really... Who remembers if they are or not their body? Who remembers something from yesterday's class? There were some significant things that happened yesterday. In the Bhagavatam. Vajrasamhita?
Vajrasamhita.
Have you read that?
Some parts.
Yes. Yajnavalkya.
Maharaj Parikshit was not here in the Bhagavatam to become fearless because he was already on the platform of fearlessness before he heard the Bhagavatam, but his hearing was more as a service for also for our benefit that we could hear the Bhagavatam.
Also, hearing the Bhagavatam is service. It's devotional service also. Just like hearing the holy names is devotional service to the holy names. It's the offering of the ears in the service of the holy name. It is the bhakti.
We also heard how Parikshit is going to leave his body, so Shukadev Goswami ends his teaching and he asked him, as ever, do you have any more questions? And this time Parikshit just had no more questions. And we heard about the point that some people argue that the Bhagavatam, why is there a first canto and why is there the end of the 12th canto, because it's supposed to be spoken by Shukadev, and it starts with the second canto and stops when Shukadev ends his speaking. So he said that it's like in a yagya. When we do the yagya, there are some preparatory things that go on, rituals before and after, and even though they are not the yagya itself, they are always included in the yagya, and they are part of the yagya, they are included in the yagya.
Where does that example come from? Just curiously.
The what?
That example. That comparison. Huh? No? Just curiously. You have such a good memory, though I have to admit it. Maybe I forgot it.
Maybe it was in the Anisla.
Possibly. I don't remember that one myself. Yes. It was an introduction, a conclusion, but I don't remember saying that at all. Maybe I wasn't here. In a moment. For a fortunate soul, it can take one moment.
Actually, Parikshit Maharaj is requesting to all the Brahmins, actually, please chant the glories of the holy name.
Vishnu.
But he has so strong desire, Subhadeva Goswami came and he chanted whole 7 days glories of the Vishnu.
What we hear is first heard by the super soul. I don't really know how it works.
What
does it knock us to? Knock us into what?
But it wasn't the sound. That subtle sound is heard by the super soul, even though we can't hear it. That was the point. There's an original subtle sound that the Omkar is based upon. And although we can't hear it, but it said that if you cover your ears. There's something you could hear. But that might be the blood going through the ears. It was just an official event, so to speak, the official part of the event. He had gone to Krishna. His consciousness was there. So, towards the end of that chapter, the description of the, because the Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Vedic literature. The compilation, the source and the expansion of the Vedas and the compilation of the Vedas are described at the end of the sixth chapter and on, and the seventh chapter. And in that context, the Yajurveda parts that were compiled by Yajnavalkya was explained. But now the Puranic literature, the continued description of the Puranas, in part of the Vedic literature, are described. Let me just check one thing here.
Can I ask a question from this
book? Yeah.
You said that Ashvatthama was reborn as?
No, he took the. He stayed alive.
He
wandered. And then he took the position in the next. In the next time there's a need for a Vyasadev, he was so purified, he actually became the compiler of the Vedas next time. He took the position of Vyasadev. The Vyasadev, who we refer to as Vyasadev, is Krishna Dwapayana Vyas. So the Vyas is the title, and the specific name of this one is Krishna Dwapayana. So he becomes, yes, he assumes that title. So he went from such a terrible situation to such an exalted situation. So, describing the Puranic literatures, Sutta Goswami said, and actually it was Sutta's words that end the great literature of the Bhagavatam. Sutta Goswami said, Sumantu Rishi, the authority on the Atharva Veda, taught his Samhita to his disciple Kabanda, who in turn spoke at the Patya and Veda Darsha. Shoklayan, Brahmabali, Modosh, and Pipalayana were disciples of Veda Darsha. Hear from me also the names of the disciples of Patya. My dear Brahmana, they are Kamuda, Sunaka, and Jajali, all of whom knew the Atharva Veda very well. Brabru and Saindavayan, disciples of Sunaka, studied the two divisions of their spiritual master's compilation of the Atharva Veda. Saindavayana's disciple of Savarna and the disciples of other great sages also studied this edition of the Atharva Veda. So one by one, the different four Vedas and how they expanded have been described and further are being described. Nakshatrakalpa, Santikalpa, Kasyapa, Angirasa, and others were also amongst the acharyas of the Atharva Veda. Now, O sage, listen as I name the authorities of the Puranic literature, on Puranic literature. Trayaruni, Kasyapa, Savarni, Akritarana, Vaishapayan, and Harita are the six masters of the Puranas. Each of them studied one of the six anthologies of the Puranas from my father, Ramaharshan, who was a disciple of Sri Vyasadev, Srila Vyasadev. I became the disciple of these six authorities and thoroughly learned all their presentations on Puranic wisdom. Ramaharshan, a disciple of Vedavyas, divided the Puranas into four basic compilations. The sage Kashyapa and I, along with Savarni and Akritarana, a disciple of Ram, learned these four divisions. O Shonaka, please hear with attention the characteristics of a Purana, which have been defined by the most eminent learned Brahmanas in accordance with Vedic literature. So this is something that's quite parallel, although slightly different from the description of the Puranas, of the characteristics of, or the topics covered in the Srimad Bhagavata Purana that's described in the 10th the first verse of the 10th chapter of the second canto, and that verse is Atra Sarga Vishagascha Stanam Poshanam Uttaya Manvatara Ikshanoketa Naroda Mukti Ashraya. So the 10 characteristics are given there of, and this will be described in somewhat different terms. O Brahmana, authorities on the matter understand a Purana to contain 10 characteristic topics: the creation of the universe, the subsequent creation of worlds and beings, that's the Atrasaga Vishaga, the maintenance of all living beings, their sustenance, the rule of various Manus, the dynasty of great kings, the activities of such kings, annihilation, motivation, and the supreme shelter. Other scholars state that the great Puranas deal with these 10 topics, while lesser Puranas may deal with 5. So this is how the Puranas are characterized according to the authorities, that a Mahapurana has all 10 topics and a lesser Purana only includes 5, Upapurana. And there's a comment here that Srila Jiva Goswami at the end of the purport has explained that the 10 principal topics of Srimad Bhagavatam are found within each of the 12 cantos. One should not try to assign each of the 10 topics to a particular canto, nor should the Srimad Bhagavatam be artificially interpreted to show that it deals with the topics successively. The simple fact is that all aspects of knowledge important to human beings summarized in the 10 categories mentioned above are described with various degrees of emphasis and analysis throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is an interesting point that Jiva Goswami makes, and that Srila Prabhupada assigned topic titles to each of the 10 cantos, first 10 cantos at least. And our Adi Prushapu did some research on this. Do you have that? Could you read that? Because it's quite relevant, if you could find it, or if you remember it. That why did Prabhupada assign the 10 different topics?
Srila Shanan Chakravarti Thakur, Sridhar Swami, Raghava Acharya, all the other Acharyas, they do ascribe these 10 topics as they are explained by Shukadev Goswami in the second chapter, in that order.
Yes.
Beginning from Canto 3. So
Prabhupada was following those Acharyas.
I don't know what's the original for this quote here, because they are not described exclusively. The cantos are not dedicated only to one topic, so that's true. But still, there is some structure that Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, for example, like the 12th canto, he says, is Nirodha.
Mm.
In that moment.
So that's an important point. Thank you. That was very helpful, that research you did. Going on to text 11. This is definition of saga. From the agitation of the original modes within the unmanifested material nature, the Mahatattva arises. From the Mahatattva comes the element false ego, which divides into 3 aspects. This threefold false ego further manifests as the subtle forms of perception, as the senses, and as the gross sense objects. The generation of all these is called creation or saga. So this is described very much in the 3rd canto. And it was also described in the 11th canto. Then the 12th verse is going to be described the secondary creation or vishaga. The secondary creation, which exists by the mercy of the Lord, is the manifest amalgamation of the desires of the living entities. Just as a seed produces additional seeds, activities that promote material desires in the performer produce moving and non-moving life forms. So the purport here. So this is the secondary creation. So all the essential ingredients are created in the primary creation, and then they are formed into the specific required forms for the living entities, etc., in the secondary creation. Purport. Just as a seed grows into a tree that produces thousands of new seeds, material desire develops into fruitive activities that stimulates thousands of new desires within the heart of the conditioned soul. The word Purushanu Grihitanam indicates that by the mercy of the Supreme Lord, one is allowed to desire and act in this world. So the activities that result from the material desires of the living entity create the Vishaga creation, is the indication here. 13th verse, Vritti. Vritti means the process of sustenance, so that's stanam, if I'm not mistaken here. Yes, stana, from the second canto, is called Vritti. Here, Vritti means the process of sustenance by which the moving beings live upon the non-moving. For a human, Vritti specifically means acting for one's livelihood in a manner suited to his personal nature. Such action may be carried out either in pursuit of selfish desire or in accordance with the law of God. And there will be obviously different results for acting in a selfish way, but as if one acts in accordance to the law of God. And then 14. In each age, the infallible Lord appears in this world amongst the animals, human beings, sages, and demigods. By his activities in these incarnations, he protects the universe and kills the enemies of Vedic culture. So this is called raksha, or protection. And poshanam, the mercy of the Lord in the previous text. Now it's called raksha. That's described in 14. In each age, the infallible Lord appears in this world amongst the animals, human beings, sages, and demigods. By his activities in these incarnations, he protects the universe and kills the enemies of Vedic culture. This is the protective activities of the Lord. That's 14. In each reign of Manu, six types of personalities appear as manifestations of Lord Hari. The ruling Manu, the chief demigods, the sons of Manu, Indra, the great sages, and the partial incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Dynasties are lines of kings originating with Lord Brahma and extending continuously through past, present, and future. The accounts of such dynasties, especially of their most prominent members, constitute the subject of dynastic history. That's Vamsa. There are four types of cosmic annihilation. That will be Niruddha. And this is Samstam. Occasional, elemental, continuous, and ultimate. All of which are affected by the inherent potency of the Supreme Lord. Learned scholars have designated this topic dissolution. Out of ignorance, the living being performs material activities and thereby becomes in one sense the cause of the creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe. Some authorities call the living being the personality underlying the material creation, while others say that he is the unmanifest self. Purport. The Supreme Lord himself creates, maintains, and annihilates the cosmos. However, such activities are performed in response to the desires of conditioned souls, who are described here as hetu, or the cause of cosmic activity. So what verse of the Bhagavad Gita? Paryayam. Jiva Bhuta. Yedam. Daryate Jagat. So the living entity, combining with the material nature, causes the creation of the universe. We don't usually think of ourselves, or we're taught not to think of ourselves as the creator of the universe. But in a very real sense, in a practical sense, the living entities create the universe in the same way that the criminals create the prison house. Certainly it's not the desire of a criminal to create a prison house. Rather, he just the last thing he wants in one sense. But due to his criminal mentality, it causes the necessity for a prison house. Since conditioned souls cannot perceive their own constitutional identity, they are described here as avyakritam, or unmanifest. In other words, the living entity cannot perceive his real form unless he is completely Krishna conscious. The Supreme Absolute Truth is present throughout all the stages of awareness, waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep, throughout all the phenomena manifested by the illusory energy and within the functions of all living entities. And he also exists separate from all these. Thus situated in his own transcendence, he is the ultimate and unique shelter. So there is no place where the Absolute Truth is not. He exists everywhere. Through all states of consciousness he is present, and in all aspects of the material creation. So therefore he is the ultimate shelter of everything. He's even the shelter of mukti. The ashraya is even the shelter, the tenth topic, or ashraya, is the shelter of mukti, and therefore he is also called mukti pala. 20. Although a material object may assume various forms and names, its essential ingredient is always present as the basis of its existence. Similarly, both jointly and separately, the Supreme Absolute Truth is always present with the created material body throughout its phases of existence, beginning with conception and ending with death. So there is no place where Krishna is not. And the all the different topics of the Bhagavatam, the nine topics other than the Ashraya, the Ashraya is the shelter and the source of those topics as well as those elements, the Atsasagra, Vishagastva, Stanam, Poshanam, Uttaya. Everything is ultimately coming from Krishna. So in one sense, there is one topic in the Bhagavatam. If we collapse all the different effects into its cause, there is only one topic of the Bhagavatam. It's Krishna. Either automatically or because of one's regulated spiritual practice, one's mind may stop functioning on the material platform of waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Then one understands the Supreme Soul and withdraws from material endeavor. Purport. As stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam 3:25-33, Jarat Yasyu Yakosham Nirgunam Analo Yata. Bhakti devotional service dissolves the subtle body of the living entity without separate endeavor, just as fire in the stomach digests all that we eat. The subtle material body is inclined to exploit material nature through sex, greed, false pride, and madness. Loving service to the Lord, however, dissolves the stubborn false ego and lifts one to pure, blissful consciousness, Krishna consciousness, the sublime perfection of existence. So this is, let me just read the comment of, part of the comment of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur on this. Giving up the three states of material consciousness by pure bhakti, consisting of hearing and chanting, the mind spontaneously becomes detached from the gunas, or the mind takes great joy spontaneously in the lotus feet of the Lord. Or by Astanga Yoga, the mind becomes detached and reaches nirvana. At that time, the mind realizes Paramatma and becomes detached from material desires. So there are two separate processes that are described. There is the Astanga Yoga process, or a meditational process, which is very similar to the Vipassana Buddhist practices, where one slows down the mind, and practically speaking, it's possible to get the mind to stop. to stop all its yoga chitta vritti narodha, that the mind stops all of its churnings. And then as soon as the mind stops, what the verse says is that one understands the Supreme Soul and withdraws from material endeavors. So this actually isn't an exaggeration. So the impersonalists or the Buddhists, they have one mechanical process of stopping the mind. And just by slowing down the mind, practically speaking, bringing it to the point of goodness, going where it goes back into the quality from whence it came at the time of creation, then immediately one becomes happy, one becomes clear, and one realizes one's non-spiritual nature. So this effect comes just by slowing down the mind. Now, the Avanti Brahmana concluded, as if we remember from the 11th canto, that there is only one cause of misery in this world and distress, and that is the rascal mind. And the mind is so causes the distress because its tendency to entangle itself in the material world because of its tendency to exploit the material world, because false ego is a characteristic of this of the mind, or one can say of the subtle body, or one can say of that these four qualities of manas, buddhi, ahankara, and citta, the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, there, it's just it's one thing and acting in different ways. So the characteristic, the underlying mood of the subtle body is one of enjoyment, exploitation. So the impersonal way of stopping this and thus ending the soul's, because as Purusha Prakriti Stohi Bhunkte Prakriti Jan, when the Bhunkte means what? When you try to enjoy prakriti jani, those things produced of material nature, karanam, the result is guna sangasa. You start playing and getting entangled with the modes of material nature, and you get caught. Under control, it's so ironic and such a brilliant setup by the Supreme Brilliant Personality of Godhead, is that we try to enjoy. And rather than enjoying, we become controlled. We get the exact opposite of what we had hoped for. Viparyato smriti. So the impersonalist system of stopping all this trouble that the mind gives us is to stop the mind, basically. And of course, that's somewhat problematic for a conditioned soul, because you can mechanically stop the mind for some time, but just imagine what you have to do to stop your mind permanently. I mean, you can't imagine what to do, because it takes the mind to imagine what to do. You can't do it. You have to be out. You have to be away from everything. And you have to remove all the impressions in your mind, because they will tend to agitate the mind. So it is such a difficult process, and it's so precarious and very dangerous to practice, to put all one's hope in achieving perfection through this, the process of slowing down and stopping the mind. Although we have to admit that sometimes it would be quite a relief to slow down and stop the mind. Just put it somewhere for a while. But the devotional process of doing that, of transforming it from the evil rascal mind into the friend mind, and is to transform its quality. And the quality the way that one transforms the quality is through the process of absorption. So when the mind is absorbed in the exploitative mood of sense gratification, then it becomes the greatest of enemies. And when the mind is absorbed in thoughts about Krishna, the mind becomes the greatest of friends, because the mind just accepts, it wants. It just wants. So if we can just get our mind to want the service of Krishna, to become attracted to that, then the mind has become our best friend. What verse of the Bhagavad Gita? Bandur atmanastasya. For one who has conquered his mind, it's the best of friends, and one who has failed to do so. So this is what it means. It means the mind becomes the friend when somehow or another it becomes attached and attracted to Krishna. This is our goal. This is what we want. So unless we chant Krishna's names, unless we become attracted to he who is all attractive, how are we going to become absorbed in him? How long can we just force and force and force? I can only think about Krishna. I can only think about Krishna. I'm not allowed to think about monkeys and bananas and other things like that. Just try to not think about monkeys for some time and see how you do. So therefore, I'll just read this comment of Vishwanath's. Again, giving up the three states of material consciousness by pure bhakti, I don't want anything else other than the service of Krishna, consisting of hearing and chanting, the mind spontaneously becomes detached from the gunas, or the mind takes great joy, visheshena ramita, spontaneously in the lotus feet of the Lord. So what do you think about that? The mind spontaneously takes pleasure in the lotus feet of the Lord. What do you think when you hear that? This is the process of devotional service consisting of hearing and chanting. What do you think about that? Yes. When will that day be mine? Kabe habe bolo se dinamo. This is the aspiration of a devotee. Bhaktivinoda Thakur sings this in such a wonderful way. When, oh when, will that day be mine, when my mind spontaneously becomes detached from the gunas and takes great joy and spontaneously in the lotus feet of Lord Krishna? And then he describes the Astanga Yoga process. Or by Astanga Yoga, so he's described the Bhakti Yoga process by hearing and chanting and becoming attracted and attached to and then absorbed. First taste, ruchi, then a shakti, absorption then attachment and absorption. So that's one way to detach the mind, by holding on to the positive, becoming attracted to the all attractive. That is the safe way. Or by Astanga Yoga, another process, the mind becomes detached and reaches nirvana. What does nirvana mean?
Full absorption.
Nirvana. There's the cessation of anything material. At that time, when the mind just stops acting, so you have to withdraw it and pull back from everything material, then the mind can realize Paramatma, and then he becomes detached from material desires. So we choose which path we want. So this is bhakti dissolving the subtle material mind, as described by Kapila Muni. 22. Sages expert in ancient histories have declared that the Puranas according to their various characteristics, can be divided into 18 major puranas and 18 secondary puranas. Excuse me just for a moment. Now, please listen carefully, and there will be one purana that will spark the major puranas, that will spark the next topic that will be spoken of in 18, 9, and 10. Here are the 18 major puranas. Now, your great assignment is to intuit or otherwise understand which is the one purana that's going to stop, to spark the next topic. The 18 major puranas are the Brahma Purana, Padma Purana, Vishnu Purana, Shiva Purana, Linga Purana, Garuda Purana, Narada Purana, Bhagavata Purana, Agni Purana, Skanda Purana, Bhavishya Purana, Brahma Vaivarta Purana, Markandeya Purana, Vamana Purana, Varaha Purana, Matsya Purana, Korma Purana, and Brahmanda Purana. Well, which one? Yes, you've all got it. You win the prize. Thank you. So this brings this listing brings Markandeya Rishi to the mind of Shonaka Rishi. And he, in the next chapter, he asks about him. Let's see if there's no comment here. I have thoroughly described to you, Sutta says, O Brahmana, the expansion of the branches of the Vedas by the great sage Vyasadeva, his disciples and the disciples of his disciples. One who listens to this narration will increase in spiritual strength. I told you there was going to be something wonderful that you get of having listened to this wonderful. But just see how things expand and it takes on it forms so differently from the origin. And but that's fine and it's completely natural, but when the tree expands, the taste of the fruit should be the same. It has the same goal. There shouldn't be something going in a completely different and opposite direction to the intended meaning of the original scripture. But see what happens in time. Just see. Now, but rather than just seeing the next chapter, we shall hear it. You ready? You sure? Okay. Sri Shonaka said, O Sutta, may you live a long life. O saintly one, best of speakers, please continue speaking to us. Indeed, only you can show men the path out of the ignorance in which they are wandering. Remember that the sages, everyone turn off their mobile phones. or put them out for the monkeys to play with. Because remember, the sages of Namasaranya were performing cows off of that ringtone. The sages of Namasaranya, cowbells are so nice, aren't they? So soothing to the mind, so natural. That the sages of Namasaranya were performing a sacrifice to ward off Kali Yuga before Sutta Goswami began speaking. And the result was, because of Kali Yuga, the sacrifice wasn't, the fire wasn't burning properly, and they were covered with the smoke, the soot from the smoke of the sacrifice. So when Sutta is speaking, they're blessing him, they're praying that he continues to speak, because he can show men the path out of the ignorance in which they are wandering. And what is that path? It's the path of the Bhagavatam. So there's a short purport here. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, the sages saw that Suta Goswami was about to end his narration of Srimad Bhagavatam, and thus they urged him to first tell the story of Markandeya Rishi. So there's three chapters on that, and then there's two conclusive chapters in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam, which will end the Bhagavatam. Authorities say that Markandeya Rishi, the son of Markandu, was an exceptionally long-lived sage who was the only survivor at the end of Brahma's day, when the entire universe was merged in the flood of annihilation. So there are four kinds of annihilations. Which one is that? The what? Which one is it called? Namitic. Namita. So at the end of every day, there is not a complete annihilation, but it's partial, but it's devastating. And at that time, there was only one survivor other than Lord Brahma himself, and this was Markandeya Rishi. But the same Markandeya Rishi, the foremost descendant of Bhrigu, who Shonaka is in that same dynasty, he took birth in my own family during the current day of Brahma. And we have not yet seen any total annihilation in this day of Brahma. Also, it is well known that Markandeya, while wandering helplessly in the great ocean of annihilation, saw in those fearful waters a wonderful personality, an infant boy lying alone within the fold of a banyan leaf. O Suta, I am most bewildered and curious about this great sage Markandeya Rishi. He lived for so long. O great yogi, you are universally accepted as the authority in all the Puranas, therefore kindly dispel my confusion. Purport. Lord Brahma's day, consisting of his 12 hours, lasts 4,320,000,000 years. That's one day. And his night is of the same duration. Apparently, Markandeya lived throughout one such day and night, and in the following day of Brahma, continued living as the same Markandeya. It seems that when annihilation occurred during Brahma's night, the sage wandered throughout the fearful waters of destruction and saw within those waters an extraordinary personality lying on a banyan leaf. All of these mysteries concerning Markandeya will be clarified by Suta Goswami at the request of the great sages. So this pastime is, in these three chapters is quite powerful and quite unique. I'm so tempted to just tell you all the wonderful secrets, but that's not fair, so I won't do it. So we'll just stick to the secrets of this particular chapter. Suta Goswami wants to speak about this. Oh, great sage Shonaka, your very question will help remove everyone's illusion, for it leads to the topics of Lord Narayan, which cleanse away the contamination of this Kali age. What did he say in response to this, to the question of Shonaka Rishi? What was his answer? The first words of his answer. Very important. Okay, let me read it again. O great sage Shonaka, now that's easy to remember. For your very question will help remove everyone's illusion. Now everyone's ears are fully perked up and listening and attentive now. We wish our illusion to be removed. Now how is this topic of Markandeya Rishi going to remove all my illusion? For it leads to the topics of Lord Narayan, which cleanse away the contamination of this Kali age. So it's the same point again, isn't it? That we should Srinvato Swakatam Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtanam. If we are eager to hear about Krishna, Vridhyantisto Yabhadrani, from within the heart, Krishna himself will remove all the illusion, all the inauspiciousness. Just try to do it yourself and see what happens. Try to remove all the inauspiciousness from your heart by your own power and see what happens. Say, from now on, I'm only going to be in the mode of pure goodness. I'm not going to desire to exploit the material energy. I will only hear about Krishna, or that part. But we just can't do it by our own power. And this is one of the essential messages of the Bhagavatam, is that if we become eager to hear about Krishna, that Krishna himself becomes eager to cleanse our heart. He reciprocates. So this topic is going to be not different from the other topics of the Bhagavatam in that it's going to be Krishna Katha. And we will find out the mysterious identity of the little boy on the banyan leaf. All that part I probably won't be able to resist talking about, even though it doesn't happen to the next chapter. Because this is... there's this wonderful purport by Prabhupada in the third canto that talks about it. Some of the mysterious meanings of this little boy. So the Markandeya Katha begins. After being purified by his father's performance of the prescribed rituals leading to Markandeya's Brahminical initiation, Markandeya studied the Vedic hymns and strictly observed the regulative principles. He became advanced in austerity and Vedic knowledge and remained a lifelong celibate, appearing most peaceful with his matted hair and clothing made of bark. He furthered his spiritual progress by carrying the mendicant's water pot, staff, sacred thread, brahmachari belt, black deerskin, lotus seed prayer beads, and bundles of kusha grass. At the sacred junctures of the day, he regularly worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead in five forms: the sacrificial fire, the sun, his spiritual master, the brahmanas, and the supersoul within his heart. So he was very powerful and very strict. He's a strict follower of the Vedic principles. Morning and evening, he would go out begging. So he was so strict, and just see how complete and well fine-tuned the system is. Because there is a tendency when someone is as good as he is good, there's such a tendency to think, I'm so much better than everyone else. And then you have to go out begging from those same people. And then when you're begging, you have to become humble. There are two things that make one humble. One is begging and the other is managing. Good point. There's only one thing that makes one humble: begging. Morning and evening he would go out begging, and upon returning he would present all the food he had collected to his spiritual master. Only when his spiritual master invited him would he silently take his one meal of the day. Otherwise he would fast. Thus devoted to austerity and Vedic study, Markandeya Rishi worshipped the Supreme Master of the senses, the Personality of Godhead, for countless millions of years. And in this way, he conquered unconquerable death. So one would think that you perform these type of austerities and activities, it's to gain something. And after millions of years, if you haven't gained it, what would be the impetus to continue? So that is how someone who is in the mode of passion thinks. It's always fruitive. I'm doing this to gain something. And if I don't gain it, I give up the activities. There's a duality between the activity and what is desired to be attained by the activity. But someone pure who's performing this in a nishkam way, he's performing his duties because these are his duties. He did it for millions of years. And he was doing it. So, he was quite amazing. Now, there are two Puranic pastimes that tell more about how did this person the soul get to be that kind of a person who could actually do this? So one comes from the Naradiya Purana, is that right?
No, the Pancharatra.
The Pancharatra, where he's in his previous life he was a Brahmin boy named Subhadra, and he was with his father, and the father said they were doing something or another. And they were hungry. They had done something, and they were hungry and returning home. And the father and they were going. The boy said he was hungry. He was only 10 years old, and the father said, "Let's not bathe. There was a river nearby, or some kind of a lake." And he said, "Let's not bathe here. It looks a bit dangerous." And the boy spoke very strongly to his father, and he said, "You're saying that it's dangerous. But usually we know that a son should listen to the father. But when I see that you're talking just like a foolish child, I'm not going to listen to you. Rather, there's no danger in this world. We're completely, basically, at the mercy of our fate, and that means ultimately of the Supreme Lord. We see that people, some people walk through a forest and that's full of snakes, and they don't get bitten by a snake at all. And there's other people who are so..." He gave so many examples of it's not our precautions that bring the results, either a favorable result. We can't avoid our fate. So when the father heard the boy speaking in such an exalted way, even though it was, in one sense, you could say insulting to him, he was just so happy that his son had so much faith and had so much knowledge. And he just embraced the boy, and they bathed, and then the boy went out to collect some different food to eat. And somehow or another, the Lord was very pleased with him, this boy Subhadra, and because he was so fixed and determined. So Lord Narayan Rishi came, and he gave him different mantras and blessed him in many ways, and he said to him, "What any benediction that you want from me?" And the boy said,
"Please promise that you will give
this kavacha that you are wearing. I want that." He said, "Oh, that's a very nice kavacha you have around here. Why don't you give it to me?" And Narayan Rishi was actually quite upset with him, because it was quite improper for him to ask that. But he hid his upsetness, and he told him, or rather Narada comments, that you can't tell the difference between, it's difficult to tell the difference between a sadhu's blessing and a sadhu's curse, because you'll get what you want from both of them, but one will not bring you what you really want. It'll bring you some improper result in the end. So anyway, the Lord gave it to him, and he very happily put it on, and he gained... But he did say that because you've done this, you're going to have to see what the world of illusion is like. So, and he benedicted him that you will live forever, basically, and you'll have all opulence. So he gained so much opulence, and he was living. And then when he passed away, and he took his next birth as the son of Markandeya Rishi, and his name was Markandeya. And there's a Puranic story about his birth also, that the father wanted a child, and he was given the choice: do you want a foolish rascal child who's going to live a long time, or do you want a saintly son who's very fixed and firm but he'll only live till 16 years of age. So with a choice like that, he chose the saintly son who would only live to 16 years of age. So this boy was so wonderful, and this is the Smokindeya Rishi. He was wonderful, he was so saintly. But the father, every time he looked at his beautiful face, he would start to cry, because he knew that he wouldn't live past his 16th birthday. So one day he told the boy about the benediction curse that he had gotten and that he wasn't going to live. So then at that point, the boy took up the life of austerity, and he began to practice these type of austerities that are described here, and he began to dress in tree bark, etc., and not cutting his hair or anything like that, and he was worshipping Lord Shiva. And in the third chapter of this pastime, he's going to get the benediction. He's going to, his devotion to Lord Shiva is going to be described, and Lord Shiva's appreciation of his devotion is also going to be described. Because he was a devotee of Lord Shiva, but also a devotee, because Lord Shiva, Vaishnam, Yata Shambhu, he's a devotee of Lord Vishnu. So he was worshipping Lord Shiva, and worshipping Lord Shiva very purely and intently, and then Yamaraj, or the servants of Yamaraj, came to take him on that day, and they couldn't, because of the brilliance of Lord Shiva's protective power. So they brought Yamaraj himself, who tried to take him, and Yamaraj was killed by Lord Shiva. When Yamaraj came, he just held on to the deity, or perhaps a Shiva Lingam. You usually see the pictures of him holding on to a Shiva Lingam, and he just held on to it. And Yamaraj couldn't touch him, couldn't take away, and rather he was killed. And of course, he was later brought back to life by the blessings of Lord Shiva. But he got the benediction from that he would remain a 16-year-old, like a 16-year-old boy, forever. And he wouldn't die. So that's part of the background of this pastime. Did you want to add anything to that? Okay. So that's how he was dressing. He was completely austere. He was completely fixed. He was so strong in his austerities and his focus of mind. But yet, remember that he had the words of Naranayan Rishi, who we'll also meet later, or in this chapter, we'll meet him, saying that you will have to see illusion. So Lord Brahma, Bhrigu Muni, Lord Shiva, Prajapati Daksha, the great son of Brahma, the great sons of Brahma, and many others amongst the human beings, demigods, forefathers, and Gulsi spirits, all were astonished by the achievements of Markandeya Rishi. In this way, the devotional mystic Markandeya maintained rigid celibacy through penance, study of the Vedas, and self-discipline. With his mind thus free of all disturbances, he turned it inward and meditated on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, on Adhokshaja, who lies beyond the material senses. While the mystic sage thus concentrated his mind by powerful yoga practice, the tremendous period of 6 lifetimes of Manu passed away. How long is that? How long is one? There are 14 Manus in a day of Brahma, and we heard about the length of Brahma's day and the length of his night. So almost half of a day of Brahma passed. So there were so many partial annihilations. 14 yuga cycles. 14 manus in a day of Brahma, and 72 yuga cycles in a day of in a lifetime of Manu. So there was so much time passed. During the 7th reign of Manu, the current age, Lord Indra came to know of Markandeya's austerities and became fearful of his growing mystic potency. Thus he tried to impede the sage's penance. Remember that word impede was used in yesterday's class? Do you remember what it was, how it was used? Do you remember? That Krishna's power is never impeded, it is never stopped. You can't stop. So Indra, although so powerful, not unlimitedly powerful, becomes fearful when someone else increases in power. This is one of the actions of false ego. Bhayam dvitiya binaveshitasyan. When one becomes absorbed in seeing the dualities of the material world, icha dvesha samutena dvanva mohena bharata, soon as one sees duality, sees something other than Krishna or Krishna's mercy, immediately there's fear. Immediately there's fear when one sees something other than Krishna and Krishna's actions. Because one's in illusion, one's in maya. Because there's, in fact, there's nothing other than Krishna. This point was just made also. It's an important point. So Indra became fearful. And to ruin the sage's spiritual practice, Lord Indra sent Cupid, beautiful celestial singers, dancing girls, the season of spring, and the sandalwood-scented breeze from the Malaya hills, along with greed and intoxication personified. Now how is Markandeya going to stand up to this? Beautiful celestial singers, Kamadev, dancing girls, the season of spring and sandalwood-scented breezes and greed and intoxication personified. O most powerful Shonaka.
Huh?
No excuse. Ignorance is not an excuse. Just to make sure that we are all happy. They went to Markandeya's hermitage on the northern side of the Himalayan mountains where Pushpabhadra River passes by the famous peak Chitra. Groves of pious trees decorated the holy ashram of Markandeya Rishi, and many saintly brahmanas lived there, enjoying the abundant pure sacred ponds. The ashram resounded with the buzzing of intoxicated bees and cooing of excited cuckoos, while jubilant peacocks danced about. Indeed, many families of maddened birds crowded that hermitage. The springtime breeze sent by Lord Indra entered, carrying cooling drops of spray from nearby waterfalls. Fragrant from the embrace of forest flowers, that breeze entered the hermitage and began evoking the lusty spirit of Cupid. Springtime then appeared in Markandeya's ashram. Indeed, the evening sky, glowing with the light of the rising moon, became the very face of spring, and sprouts and fresh blossoms virtually covered the multitude of trees and creepers. So what do these descriptions sound like? What do they remind you of? Huh? Yeah, things like that. It's like Vrindavan. But what's the difference? What's the difference? That in Vrindavan everything is meant for Krishna, and here what Indra is trying to do is incite the spirit that all these are to facilitate my enjoyment. That's the material world. And if one is fixed and everything is for Krishna, then all the opulences and sweetnesses and the beauties of the material world, they're meant to enhance the pleasure of Krishna. And then there's no problems. But if one has traces of the enjoying spirit, there will be problems. So Cupid, the master of many heavenly women, then came. So the scene was set for Kamadev himself to come. And he came there holding his bow and arrows. He was followed by groups of Gandharvas playing musical instruments and singings. So the sage was in his meditation. His mind was withdrawn. So Cupid, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, Cupid came with persons who had groups of instruments and singers. The suffix ka has the sense of possessing. The sage perceived their presence somewhat in his mind, and he began to tremble. 23. These servants of Indra found the sage sitting in meditation, having just offered his prescribed oblations into the sacrificial fire. His eyes closed in trance. He seemed invincible, like fire personified. The women danced before the sage, and the celestial singers sang to the charming accompaniment of drums, cymbals, and veenas. Try to meditate while all this is going on, and just to make sure that you can't ignore it, there's the drums, the cymbals, etc. Well, the son of passion, greed personified, spring, and the other servants of Indra all tried to agitate Markandeya's mind. Cupid drew his five-headed arrow and fixed it upon his bow. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur tells us what the five heads, they are drying up, bewilderment, agitation, suffering, and exhilaration. Just the mind, all unsteadinesses of the mind. Agitation, suffering, exhilaration, bewilderment, and drying up. The apsara, Punji Kastali, made a show of playing with a number of toy balls. Her waist seemed weighed down by her heavy breast, and the wreath of flowers in her hair became disheveled. As she ran about after the balls, glancing here and there, the belt of her thin garment loosened, and suddenly the wind blew her clothes away. Cupid, thinking he had conquered the sage, at that time shot his arrows. But all these attempts to seduce Markandeya proved futile, just like the useless endeavors of an atheist. O learned Shonaka, while Cupid and his followers tried to harm the sage, they felt themselves being burned alive by his potency. Thus they stopped their mischief, just like children who have aroused a sleeping snake. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, they became frightened, thinking, we do not know what will happen now. He's angry at us. From the example of the snake, it is understood that the sage first became angry on the arousal of lust, and then he controlled both lust and anger. O Brahmana, the followers of Lord Indra had impudently attacked the saintly Markandeya, yet he did not succumb to any influence of false ego. So succumbing to the enjoying spirit in any way means that's the false ego in action. For great souls, such tolerance is not at all surprising. The mighty King Indra was most astonished when he heard of the mystic prowess of the exalted sage Markandeya, and he saw how Cupid and his associates had become powerless in his presence. Desiring to bestow his mercy on the saintly Markandeya, who had perfectly fixed his mind in self-realization through penance, Vedic study, and observance of regulative principles, the Supreme Personality of Godhead personally appeared before the sage in the form of Nara and Narayan. One of them was of whitest complexion, the other blackish, and they both had four arms. Their eyes resembled the petals of blooming lotuses, and they wore garments of blackish deer skin and bark, along with the three strand sacred thread. In their hands, which were most purifying, they carried the mendicant's water pot, straight bamboo staff, and lotus seed prayer beads, as well as the all-purifying Vedas in the symbolic form of bundles of dharba grass. So he was very similar in his appearance, and Lord Naranarayan, Narayan Rishi, he is the supreme ascetic. And when he was challenged by whom? By? Yeah, and then what did he show Cupid? So many expansions of, they were all coming from him. So he was not the least, this is all his energy. This is his energy, his inferior energy, his material energy, but it's all his energy. This again is what the absolute truth means, that nothing is external to him. So he is the supreme mystic. He is the supreme, supremely austere. He is the supreme ascetic. Their bearing was tall, and their yellow effulgence, the color of radiant lightning, appearing as austerity personified, they were being worshipped by the foremost demigods. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments, they wore skins, the skin of the black deer, and bark for clothing, and a sacred thread of newly woven thread in three strands. They held water pots in their hands. They held the Vedas, which purify men. Some say this means they held dharba, representing the Vedas. They were the personification of austerity. They were tall. Their yellow effulgence looked like flashing lightning. These two sages, Nara and Narayan, were the direct personal forms of the Supreme Lord. When Markandeya Rishi saw them, he immediately stood up and then with great respect offered them obeisances by falling down flat on the ground like a stick. The ecstasy of seeing them completely satisfied Markandeya's body, mind, and senses and caused the hairs of his body to stand on end and his eyes to fill with tears. Overwhelmed, Markandeya found it difficult to look at them. Standing with his hands folded in supplication and his head bowed in humility, Markandeya felt such eagerness that he imagined he was embracing the two lords. In a voice choked with ecstasy, he repeatedly said, I offer you my humble obeisances. I offer you my humble obeisances. Namo, nama, 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 namo, nama. He gave them sitting places and washed their feet, and then he worshipped them with presentations of argya, sandalwood pulp, fragrant oils, incense, and flower garlands. Markandeya Rishi once again bowed down at the lotus feet of these two most worshipable sages who were sitting at ease, ready to bestow all mercy upon him. He then addressed them as follows. Sri Markandeya said, how are we going to do this? Just one moment. I'm going to ask you who just listen and try to summarize this in one small statement for each of the verses. Almighty Lord, or what hits you is the essence. Oh, Almighty Lord. So Markandeya is seeing them after passing that test. He sees them and he says, oh, Almighty Lord, how can I possibly describe you? You awaken the vital air, which then impels the mind, senses, and power of speech to act. This is true for all ordinary conditioned souls and even for great demigods like Brahma and Shiva. So it is certainly true for me. Nevertheless, you become the intimate friend of those who worship you. So what did you get from that verse? Yeah, that's the second part, that despite Krishna's position, he becomes intimate, surit, suridam sarvabhutanam, intimate friend Bhavabandhu, what a nice word, Bhavabandhu. You become the intimate friend, bhajatam asi Bhavabandhu. You become the intimate friend of those who worship you. So, no, that's the second part in the conclusion. Now, what was said right before that? Describing the that the Lord is indescribable because He's the source of the power that cause that gives one the ability to describe Him. So how could you describe the source of your power to describe? Because your power of description cannot be as unlimited as the one that's giving you the power to describe. But Srila Jiva Goswami comments that the Lord Himself, and it's a wonderful point, is the cause of the activities of devotional service that are performed by a devotee. That's in Bhakti Sundarbha, Ched 144. That it is Krishna that gives the potency for devotional service. Therefore, as Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Shakti Nahivina Tarpavartana, that is, Krishna Shakti is at work when there is success in devotional service. The devotee therefore gives the credit to Krishna, and Krishna gives the credit to the devotee. But it's the devotee's energy that is at work, or Krishna's energy that's at work. So I summarize this. You are indescribable as you're the source of the power of the spoken word, yet you become the intimate friend of those who worship you. So what's the connection between the two points? What would you call it when someone who's unlimitedly powerful becomes intimate friend with someone who's powerless?
Mercy.
Yeah, mercy. There's a condescending of mercy there's a meaning of condescension which isn't very nice. It implies some arrogance, some pride. But he's coming, he's so kind, he's so powerful, but yet he'll become intimate friend. Not just he goes beyond the boundaries of I'm the master and you're the servant. But he becomes an intimate friend. Bhavabandhu. So this is what he says. Markandeya Rishi speaks so wonderfully. But because there's the prayers go up to the 49, so there's 10 prayers. So why don't we break now? And then we shall continue with the other 9 prayers at exactly 12:30, Krishna willing. Now, but the first question I'm going to ask when we sit down is, who remembers the essence of the first prayer? And I know that you all remember it, because it's such a nice point about Krishna's kindness. And who does he bestow that kindness on? Someone who worships him. So hearing, just see how hearing about Lord Narayan, which is what Sutta Goswami said, hearing about Lord Narayan removes the contaminations of Kali Yuga. So what are the contaminations of Kali Yuga? Increase of false ego. Increase of turning our back on Krishna means turning our back on our relationship with Krishna, and increase false ego means I'm the center, I'm the enjoyer, I'm the controller. So when we hear Hare Krishna, we hear this wonderful prayer that you are so kind, O Lord, that you allow, you condescend so that you come down and become an intimate friend of those who worship you. What desire naturally comes to the heart. To worship him, which is what you were saying in different terms.
Certain.
Well, to worship him. And that's, because he's so nice. He's worthy of taking shelter of. He's worthy of serving. So it works in a very simple, practical way, because by associating with these exalted personalities through their instructions and prayers and words, some of their mood through the process of hearing enters our consciousness and thus dispels the dark clouds of Kali. And not only does it enter our consciousness with an idea, oh yes, I should do this, but that idea is itself purifying. Because this is worshipping. We're worshipping through our ears by hearing. This is the process of serving. Because this is how Prahlad Maharaj defines bhakti. Shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu, smaranam. So this is bhakti. It is worshipping the Lord with devotion. And it gives birth to it as well. Okay.